You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
Hi, John Rubino.
Hello, John. This is Rod Adams. How are you?
Oh, hey, Rod. Great. How are you?
I'm doing just great today.
All right. Well, thanks for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad you could make it. I've just finished the book a couple of days ago, and it's an interesting timing for your book. Lots of things have changed since you wrote it.
Haven't they? You know, 6 months ago, when I was putting this together, oil was soaring. But that's kind of the risk you take when you write a book, though, because there's a six-month gap in between writing it and having the thing hit the stores. And you really hope that it's not outdated or completely been proven wrong by the things that happened in the meantime. So,
well, I'm not sure if you've been proven wrong, but it's certainly been quite a change in the economic situation and, of course, the energy situation.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, not the long-term energy situation. We still, when things start to recover and they've printed enough money and bailed out enough of these companies, and things start to come back, we'll still have the same energy issues that we had back when oil was $150 a barrel.
I don't
so
disagree.
Hopefully we've learned the lesson, and we got to make the steps now that it takes to fix things next time around. Because this is our third oil crisis, and we didn't prepare for any of them, any of the subsequent ones after the other ones.
Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and introduce you, and then we'll continue talking. All that will probably still stay up in the show. But this is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 116. And with me tonight is John Rubino, who is the author of Clean Money. John is also the publisher of GreenStockInvesting.com. He has an MBA from New York University and worked as a Wall Street analyst before deciding to become a writer. How are you doing, John?
Doing great, Rod. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. Fortunately, my day job is a very secure government job. So, I mean a secure meaning I get a paycheck every 2 weeks.
Okay, you're one of the lucky ones then.
Yeah. I spent about 30 years in the military. So.
Okay, good for you. Yeah, I tell you what, it's terrifying out there right now. I get emails from people constantly who've seen their 401ks just evaporate and wonder if they're going to get laid off. And all of a sudden, they don't get to retire like they thought they were going to. Very scary times.
Well, you know, I get a newsletter from a guy named Jason Calacanis, and Jason's a serial entrepreneur, but his newsletter today was very inspiring to me. Basically, what he said was, you know, America's been, not working hard enough and borrowing an awful lot and spending an awful lot. Maybe it's time to just roll up our sleeves and work really hard for a while.
We're going to learn the lesson that our grandparents learned during the Depression. And, you know, for the most part, I think it changes you for the better. I'm not sure whether it's worth the pain to the people going through it, but it produces a better culture because we've been unbelievably decadent for the last 30 years. You know, you can you draw a chart of GDP versus total debt in the U.S. economy. It starts soaring in the 1980s. And the arc gets even steeper in the 1990s and just goes off the chart in this decade. So basically, about the time the first baby boomer turned 30, we became a debt-based society. And we didn't stop until everything fell apart in 2007.
Yeah, and of course, at the end of 2007, things still looked okay for many people. But as you say, many of the signs were there.
Well, that's when the housing bubble began to burst in the hottest markets.
Yeah.
So Florida and California started to fall apart then, and then now it's spreading to everything. So, and we don't know where it ends. That's the scary part.
So tell me, what inspired you to become a green stock investor?
Well, this is an idea I've been kicking around for years. And the premise was that at some point we would start paying too high a price for the energy infrastructure that we have developed. In other words, a petroleum-based or fossil fuels-based energy infrastructure. It just had too many problems, and they were all going to come to a head, whether it was geopolitical first or global warming or high prices because of peak oil, whatever. Something was going to happen to make our dependence on fossil fuels untenable, and when that happened, it would create a gigantic market for other sources of energy. So it would be a spectacular investment play when it happened. And as energy prices started to go up in the last few years, it seemed like the timing was getting better. So I put the idea together, shopped it around, and found a reasonably hospitable market out there. A lot of publishing houses had the same idea, and they wanted to bring out books that were generally in this theme. You know, there's 100 peak oil books out there right now. And now there are a lot of green investing books coming to market. So it's fashionable. So it was an easy sell. And it was a lot of fun to research because this is really fascinating stuff. There's a lot of controversy about how we get from here to sustainability. And a lot of these technologies still have to prove themselves in the marketplace. And there are new inventions coming along every day that might make a lot of what we think of as mainstream green tech obsolete. But the process is going to be fascinating to watch and very dangerous as an investment, but also potentially really profitable if you play it right. So that's my motivation. And so now that I've got the book out, I get to be kind of in the middle of the action for a while.
Yeah, one of the things that I noticed in your book, I was really interested by the chapters you wrote about the what you thought may happen in 2008. Obviously, you wrote the book probably at the very beginning of 2008, and you weren't too far off.
Oh, about the financial crisis?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, actually, my two previous books were on those subjects. I did a book on the coming real estate bust and then one called The Collapse of the Dollar. In the last few years. So that's sort of my, to the extent that I have an area of expertise, bubble economics is it. And so that was an easy chapter to write because it was all just from memory, from doing the research on the other books. And yeah, it's playing out according to the script. We borrowed way too much money, and we created all kinds of crazy financial instruments that never should have existed, and now they're all falling apart. The leveraged speculating community is imploding. And that's taken down a lot of the real economy with it. So this is very much like 1930 or 1931. And the big difference is that as the system implodes, the government this time around is armed with an unlimited printing press. And so back in the Depression, we were on the gold standard, and they couldn't just flat out print all the new dollars that they wanted to. This time they can. So the crisis probably goes in a different direction.
The Weimar Republic could print all they wanted as well.
Yeah, exactly. This time we're more likely to have a hyperinflation than a deflationary depression. And that plays into the alternative energy thesis because the new administration, when it comes in January, is going to be faced with an economy that is still in crisis, and they're going to need to spend massive amounts of new money on something. You know, they're going to have to increase government spending to keep the economy from falling into a depression. And the question will be, what do they spend it on? And I think we know from what Barack Obama has said during the campaign, and just generally what Democrats believe, that a lot of what they spend money on is going to be alternative energy. They're going to want to remake the energy infrastructure of the U.S. and to an extent the world along what is generally defined as greener lines. And that means they'll pump huge amounts of money into wind and solar and smart grid and new batteries for potentially electric cars. And so for a while, Those things are going to be really interesting investments just because they'll have so much government money flowing in. Now, then we have to find out if they really work. And that's where it gets interesting. And then we have to find out if the all this money that they're printing and pumping into the system doesn't destabilize the economy in different ways. Like you said, we could go into a Weimar-style hyperinflation down the road because of what we do, and then all bets are off. But in the meantime, clean tech is probably going to be favored in the marketplace because it's got such a stiff tailwind right now from the government. You know, they'll be spending so much money on it that alone should increase the sales and the profits of a lot of these companies.
But of course, governments aren't always very good at picking the right technologies because the decision makers often aren't engineers, aren't people who have deep understanding of what really works, and they're pretty susceptible to a sales pitch.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the last thing you want in a well-run economy is the government trying to pick winners, right? And that's, you know, of the many downsides of the aftermath of the credit bubble, one of them is that we're going to have the government out there deciding which technologies win and which technologies lose. Now, that's not a good thing. And to the extent, I mean, you know, it's highly likely that they pick the big name glitzy industries and won't understand the marginal stuff that might have a better future because, like you said, they're not engineers, they're not scientists. They're going to do what buys the most votes in the short run. Even though they, you know, in their own minds, they're doing what's best for society, but they're always going to be acting out of the need to win the next election. And, you know, it's not a good way to run economic policy, but it's what we're stuck with after 30 years of horrendous mistakes. So I think as investors, and again, this is an investment book. This isn't so much a technology roadmap as it is a set of ideas for playing the market as we will probably find it in the next few years, you know, investing successfully for the, say, the first 4 years of an Obama administration.
So I've got a question for you, though, of course.
Sure.
You know the name of this podcast. I've got to ask, as an investor, what would happen if you're wrong about your dismissal of nuclear power?
Well, it's important to understand that I didn't, in this book, I don't include it as a green technology, but I don't dismiss it. I think nuclear has a place in the system going forward. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's far better than coal or oil because it doesn't produce greenhouse gases. And I think, you know, if we were a well-run country that was organized rationally, that nuclear would play a bigger role than it does now. And there are two reasons why that may not be the case. And one is that the guys in charge don't seem to like it very much. And, you know, the whole storage issue and just the sense that that it represents big centralized power versus the distributed networks that are possible with solar and batteries and things like that. So I think that we won't see as much federal money flowing into nuclear going forward as we will into solar and wind. And then the other thing personally that makes me a little nervous about nuclear is the whole dirty bomb thing. You know, one of these days, somebody is going to get a hold of some radioactive material. They're going to put it in the back of a van loaded with other kinds of explosives. They're going to drive it to the middle of some city, and they're going to set it off. And then, you know, that material may have come from some old Russian suitcase nuke or, you know, an old-style nuclear reactor that has nothing in terms of engineering to do with today's more modern nukes. But all people are going to see is radioactivity, you know, and it's going to be a visceral reaction that that if you own, you know, stock in a nuclear power company or a uranium producer or something like that, that you're going to see that stock go way down because for a while, until it gets sorted out, people are going to just paint the entire industry with a broad brush and sell it off, and that to me is a risk that doesn't exist with a lot of these other alternative energy sources that that may not be as good in the short run in terms of how much power you get for how many dollars, but they don't carry a big risk that, that some kind of a big event can happen that just taints the whole industry. So I'm intrigued with the next generation nuclear plants, which would be fun to talk about if you'd like to, and especially with the work being done in fission. I think that's fascinating stuff, and I think there's definitely a future for it. But as an investor, I worry about the big risks that adhere to industries like this.
Well, of course, I worry about big risks as well, and I also actually, even though I'm a nuke, I have a pretty good amount of sympathy for the idea of a distributed grid with much smaller power plants, because quite honestly, electricity, unlike communications, is not inherently limited to networks. I mean, we all drive around in a distributed supply of electricity when we're in our car. We have power to run our air conditioners and our radios and all that stuff. You know, we can each have our own generator, except it'd be a pain in the neck to operate and make a lot of noise and smell a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I grew up in a nuclear environment with small nuclear power plants that operated off the grid, as a matter of fact, because I was trained as a submarine officer.
Okay, yeah.
So,
and as I understand it, the concept is becoming viable for, non-submarine use now too, right? We can set up small nuclear plants and run small towns, neighborhoods, cities, city neighborhoods, things like that.
Exactly. That's one of I'm fascinated by. There's a couple of startup companies, one called Hyperion and one called NuScale, which are both developing much smaller nukes. Hyperion is about 25 megawatts electric, and NuScale's is about 45 megawatts electric, which is still actually a pretty good sized power plant, but compared to a central station 1500 megawatt plant, they're pretty small. And I know that there are also a few more established companies who are feverishly working on good designs that they're going to be introducing in the next year or so. And that has the potential, I think, to have a real impact on the wind and solar and biofuels markets.
As a competitor?
Well, sure. If you have an emission-free,
mm-hmm.
reliable, 24/7, inexpensive power source, why would you continue to vote for 2 cents per kilowatt-hour subsidies for wind and solar?
Yeah, well, because a lot of countries have already expanded their use of nuclear power and seem to be happy with it. And so I think you could see something like that be very big in China, for instance, because they, assuming they don't fall into a depression here too, they're going to be desperate for more power going forward. And their air pollution problem is immense. And, wind turbines are in backlog right now. So even if they wanted to go completely to wind, they couldn't set it up in any kind of a time frame. So in a market like that, you could see huge demand for safe, economical, modular nuclear plants. So it's completely possible that some of these companies that you mentioned are going to do really well. They'll sell a lot of their early plants, go public, and be hot stocks for a while. So I wouldn't write them off, and I would take a look at them and consider them, but still, I would want to factor in the risks that we talked about before.
Okay.
And
your dirty bomb scenario, just to give people a little bit of comfort, if that was such a thing to happen, I would venture to bet a whole lot of money that the source of the radioactivity would not be from a secure nuclear facility like a nuclear power plant. It would probably be from a hospital or an irradiation facility or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've been to the plants around the country, or many of them, not all of them, but it just isn't that easy to get in and get out, and certainly not easy to get out with any kind of material at all.
Yeah. No, I, agree. And more than likely, there's so much on the black market right now that you wouldn't even have to steal it today. You could just buy it from somebody. And, you know, at least as the story goes, Russia, or the Soviet Union, when it fell, lost track of a bunch of its nuclear material. So it might be out there somewhere. And, you know, it's a horrible thought. But there are probably some bad guys who are right this minute trying to get their hands on it, and maybe a few are succeeding.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that us nukes like to remind people is that one thing a nuclear power plant can do that no windmill or solar panel can do is to destroy bomb material. And for the last 17 years, half of the nuclear power in the U.S., which makes it 10% of the electricity in the U.S., has come from destroying bomb material,
mm-hmm.
which is a pretty interesting thing. The material's here. It's above the ground. It's been refined. We've got to do something to get rid of it, and there's no better way than to, you know, make power with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree more that in terms of economics, nuclear looks really good. And I think even in an Obama administration, it'll probably grow in the U.S. just because coal is becoming non-viable. Oil has even bigger problems, and in the rest of the world, it's liable to grow more quickly still. So, I think I own stock in one uranium company,
yeah.
USEC from Maryland. But,
yeah. The uranium market's a tough one because unlike the coal and oil and natural gas market, most of the money in nuclear is not in the fuel material. Most of the money that we spend in our nuclear plants today, about 70% of it is people's salaries,
mm-hmm.
which is really kind of cool from my point of view, because they are investments that do end up building a lot of good high-tech jobs, a lot of knowledge base, and not a whole lot of money going to the guy who just happens to live on top of a sea of oil.
Yeah, the whole domestic resource thing is a big deal. And
well,
it becomes a bigger deal as time goes on.
Well, unfortunately, we don't mine much uranium in the U.S., but we've got a lot already mined. And the best
source
of uranium,
we have our old weapons.
Yeah, the best source of uranium are in the world are Canada and Australia, so they both like us still.
Yeah. If we spend money in Canada, that's almost like spending it in the U.S.
Yeah. Now, in your book, you talked a lot about some of the developments in solar power. Where do you see the real interest going to be in solar? Is it going to be these massive solar thermal plants, or is it going to be the distributed rooftop, or both?
Well, The distributed rooftop solar is just about here now. In a sunny place with a modest subsidy, you can slap solar panels on your roof, and it's basically a decent economic deal all around. And so we're going to see dramatic growth in Arizona and California and places like that going forward, especially if we have some kind of a national rebate or subsidy of some sort or a feed-in tariff or whatever. And the advantage that solar has on a rooftop is that it's competing with the retail price of electricity rather than the wholesale price. And it's getting close to being competitive to that price as its cost falls. And the next generation of thin film solar and more efficient traditional solar panels are cheaper still. So if they continue with this momentum, and it looks like they're going to because there's breakthroughs happening all over the place in labs all over the world, there will come a time in the not too distant future when solar stands on its own two feet economically versus retail electric prices. And at that point, you'll see the arc just take off, and it'll grow dramatically, and it'll be a major source of electricity going forward. And now, in utility-scale plants, it's a little bit of a tougher nut to crack because you've got to compete with coal-fired plants and nuclear, and these are very, very cheap generators of electricity. So solar thermal is getting there, but not there yet. So it would require substantial subsidies to compete in today's market. But again, it's getting cheaper too, and it's possible that the subsidies will come. So it's possible that we see dramatic growth in that sector too. And the other thing to understand is that we already dramatically subsidize the price of oil and coal in different ways. You know, we don't include the cost of if global warming is indeed real and going to cause the trouble that it looks like it may cause, then we're not including the cost of that in the price of coal right now.
Right. People get to dump their waste in the atmosphere for free.
Exactly. Exactly. So we're not allocating costs accurately. And of course, with oil, we got to maintain the global military empire to protect our oil supplies. And if you included that in the price of gas, gas would be a lot more expensive. So it's possible that that we'll end up subsidizing solar thermal as a way of offsetting the, or maybe we'll use higher taxes on coal and as a way to reallocate those costs and then shift some of it to solar thermal, and it'll grow too. You know, that, I think that's something that we're likely to see out of the U.S. government going forward. Some plan that shifts the cost around, and then that'll make solar thermal economic too. I mean, I don't think it's ever going to be as cheap as nuclear, but I think it can be made acceptably cheap with subsidies that aren't outrageous in the scale of subsidies as they are today. So it's possible that we'll see a lot of those dotting the deserts out there in the western U.S. going forward.
So how long do you think that we're going to need to subsidize these clean energy sources, the alternative energy sources, before they can stand on their own 2 feet?
Well,
how hard do you think it'll be to convince the people who are getting the subsidies that they really are ready to stand on their own 2 feet?
I don't know. I think with each one, it's a different trend line and a different break-even point, and they're all heading that way, but they're various distances away, and so a lot of it depends on government policy. A lot of it depends on breakthroughs that haven't happened yet, but that you can reasonably expect because there's just so much brain power being devoted to it now. So I think rooftop solar is close in the sunniest places. You know, within 5 years, it's possible that Arizona rooftop solar will be able to compete even up with most forms of wholesale electricity, delivered to a retail customer. And the less sunny places, the break-even point is further out, but progress is continuing. And things like solar thermal and photovoltaics in utility scale setups, it's further away, but again, it might be a societal decision to subsidize it until it becomes economic. And calling something competitive also depends on how we allocate the costs. So if we were accurately allocating the cost to coal, it's possible a lot of these things are competitive today. So that's a political decision, and it's one that that's going to be sorted out in the next few years, I think. And it'll be an interesting process because if we end up accurately assigning costs to all these things, then the economics of a lot of these things really change. It'll be fun to watch and hard to predict.
Yeah, that's no doubt that the economics will change quite a bit there's a tax on carbon, which I personally prefer a tax vice a cap and trade. What is your opinion of that?
Well, I think either one would end up getting us where we, assuming we want to get beyond fossil fuels, that either one would speed up the process because it raises the cost of fossil fuels, which makes other stuff economic. So cap and trade programs are, you know, as an investment guy, I like markets, and I like the energy that creating securities that are traded and that lead to new investment produces. But the cap and trade systems that are out there so far have been complicated and haven't always worked as promised. So I think they would have to be fine-tuned and perfected before we can say, well, this is the way to go. And I don't think they have been yet, and I think we need to find out if it's possible to have a cap and trade system that does everything that it promises. And that's something we're going to find out in a few years, because we're trying these things, we're doing the experiments, and by the middle of the next decade, we're going to know for sure whether a system like that will work. And we'll probably have carbon taxes imposed in some markets at the same time. We're going to see how that works, and then we'll have, you know, real world data that we can use to make decisions going forward. But I think they're both worth a try, and I think the end result is something that we should be going for. You know, we definitely want to limit the amount of carbon that we're putting into the air, and we want to limit the amount of money that we're spending on stuff that we're buying from regimes that we don't necessarily trust or don't have our interests at heart. So we'll see. But I think it's going to be a fascinating time in which we learn a lot.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I sometimes wonder why we focus so much on carbon dioxide when there's so many other nasty stuff coming out of coal-fired power plants.
Oh yeah. Well, CO2 is easy to grasp for most people. You know, that's what we that's kind of the catch-all term for greenhouse gases now. Because if we had to memorize five other greenhouse gases, we'd just get confused, and you know, you'd lose the point of the discussion.
Well, I'm not talking about the greenhouse gas. I'm talking about the acid rain and the mercury
and the fly ash.
You know, the small particles that cause asthma and all the other nasty stuff that we've been putting up with. And we used to call, back in my day, they called it air pollution.
I grew up by a coal plant in East Liverpool, Ohio, and the air was unbelievable back then. We just took it for granted. But there would be soot, just kind of, you know how snow sometimes gets blown across the road on a dry day? Well, this would be black soot being blown across the road. So, yeah, we've come a long way since then, but we have a long way to go. And, yeah, you know, we get back to the unallocated costs of something like coal, where if we really added up what all this stuff costs us and we applied that to the price of coal, then it wouldn't look so good anymore. And then you get into things like mountaintop mining, where in Appalachia to get coal, they'll blow the top off of a mountain. They'll pollute everything for miles around, and then dig out the coal, and then this maybe unique ecosystem is gone forever. Have I ever seen it?
Yeah.
No, I haven't. I've seen pictures and I've seen documentaries, and right. I've never driven past something like that when it was going on.
It's really horrible to see that. I spend a fair amount of time hiking in the Appalachians, and my wife and I visited West Virginia and seen some of the areas, and you know, even the ones that are, quote, reclaimed, it's like taking a big level to an area, and then they plant grass on it instead of all the trees that used to be there.
Yeah. And, you know, and what's the dollar value of something like that? It's nobody keeps track of that, but it's, in my opinion, it's high, and we're wasting it. So, yeah, getting beyond that as soon as possible would be a really good thing.
So I bet there may be some of the people in the green community who would take issue with your feelings about genetically modified food.
Yeah, that's a controversial one that I've been hearing about. The reason that I included that in the book is because there are a lot of people, a lot of places that just won't get to eat unless there's a way to grow things in drought-stricken soil or soil that's been polluted with salt from irrigation or where the current types of crops are too low yield. So it's possible to genetically engineer crops that'll grow in situations like that and not draw as many nutrients from the ground, so the soil stays rich longer. And you know, there's a real danger of Frankenfood incidents out there one of these days, where it turns out some genetically modified plant is dangerous in some way that wasn't predicted and wasn't accounted for and causes a lot of trouble, and that changes everything. But in the meantime, it looks like this is something that has a huge future. You know, genetically modified plants are going to get more and more efficient at using nutrients to produce food, and they're going to win more and more of the market, and that's just the way it is. And so a company like Monsanto that you can point to them and look at a lot of their practices and just be appalled, yet at the same time, it's almost certain that the products that they're producing and the processes that they're developing will play a big role in the food production of the future. So I don't know. I think they're worth watching, and I think that we have to think long and hard about whether we class something like that as green, but for the purposes of this book, I chose to.
Well, I understand what you're saying. Of course,
yeah.
You know, humans have been modifying crops and animals for a very long time. We just did it more slowly. Of course, we did have an interesting period. I think they called it the Golden Revolution, when we came up with some really quick growing rice and things like that. That had in part of the Green Revolution, I guess, that was actually the first Green Revolution was about food and growing food a lot faster. Higher yields, and I mean, that's what allowed us to get to 6 billion people, most of whom have something to eat.
Yeah. I mean, that involved synthetic fertilizers and pesticides to an extent.
And mutations.
And
artificially induced
new strains
mutations.
Of crop. Yeah. And so the question is, now that fertilizer is harder to get, since it's derived from natural gas, and pesticides are being shown to cause a lot of problems, how do we continue to feed 6 billion people, and then 8 billion people, and then 9 billion people, which looks like where we'll top out population-wise? And one of the ways that we'll do that is with crops that are optimized for their environments and that produce higher levels of vitamins, so that even if you don't get a lot to eat, what you do get to eat is highly nutritious. So, yeah, that's where we're headed, and that's the challenge. And I think next generation agricultural practices are going to be absolutely fascinating, and they go beyond genetically modified crops. I think the really interesting stuff that's going on involves vertical farming and open ocean aquaculture and things like that. I think those are fascinating ideas that aren't necessarily as controversial, because they're almost completely green, even in the strictest definition of that term. So I that stuff isn't investable now, but it's fascinating, and it's going to be very cool going forward.
Yeah, and it looked like the vertical farms that you talked about would be very productive, but probably require a fairly significant electrical supply.
Yeah. So, what you have to do with those things is, and for your listeners who aren't familiar with the concept, basically what this means is, vertical farming is taking a building that's in a city and turning it into a big hydroponic farm. So you grow crops within this building using water instead of soil. And then, so you've got this continuous farmer's market around the building. You know, you're growing crops year-round without pesticides, at least in the conception of these things. And so you've got fresh, locally grown produce continuously from this building that's right in the middle of the city. And the hydroponic farms are very productive. So you can build one that's, one city block, 30 stories high, and it'll feed 50,000 people, according to the guys who are now designing them. So we don't have to grow something in, you know, grapes in Chile and ship them up here and use all the oil and other fossil fuels that it takes to get them here. We grow them here locally, year-round, and do it without polluting. Very cool idea. But like you said, it's energy intensive. So there would have to be a way to either tap into green power that's on the grid already, or else use rooftop solar or rooftop wind or biofuels from the waste that the plants generate. You know, the stocks of plants right now are basically not used for anything, but in a vertical farm, you burn them or whatever. Carbon neutral, but it provides heat and electricity for the building. So there are a lot of really cool tie-ins that are possible with something like this. And the people who are proposing them now, they have funding to do some reasonably large-scale pilot projects. So we'll know in the next few years if this is feasible. And if it is, it creates a whole constellation of investment possibilities, because you've got the guys designing plants that are optimized for that environment, and you've got all the people making specialized machinery and people building business models around networks of large-scale vertical farms. So it'll be a very cool segment of the economy if it ever comes to be.
Yeah, I think if you do the energy balance, you're going to find that rooftop solar is quite inadequate, since a farm, essentially collects all of the energy from the sun over a single story.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you had a 30-story building, the other 29 stories wouldn't be getting enough light.
Oh yeah. Rooftop solar panels would be, it would be one part of the energy picture for something like this. I don't think at best case technology 10 years from now, that you could run a whole building on solar panels on the roof. Although, next generation thin film solar can go on the walls too, and the windows. So you can expand the amount of space that you can use to gather solar energy.
Yeah, well, don't forget that the amount of energy coming from the sun is a function of the angle at which it's striking the panel as well.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Wall-mounted solar panels are not going to collect much energy.
Well,
your legs get much energy when you're getting a suntan standing up.
Yeah, yeah. None of this is a solution in and of itself. With things like small-scale windmills and rooftop solar, it's just one part of an equation that has a lot of moving parts. But one breakthrough that was just announced last month in solar is that they figured out ways to develop solar panels that capture indirect light and use it as well as direct light, so that as you said, the sun that's hitting your legs at an angle, giving you a little bit of a suntan, can now be converted into electricity more efficiently than it could have before. So that raises the potential for solar panels that are on walls and aren't getting direct sunlight, but are still getting, ambient light. So, none of it is a panacea, but all of it can contribute.
Yep. I know that you're an investment guy and not an engineer, but I just have to use a little analogy for you. It's like saying that a field full of pennies has money on it, but it's a real pain in the ass to go pick them all up.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. See, that's the challenge for solar, because it's not very efficient right now, and it has to become more efficient in order to spread beyond just the, Arizona rooftop market.
Right.
And that's their challenge. And, a huge amount of money is being poured into it, a lot of brain power is at work on it, and a lot of interesting announcements are being made from labs every day. And so the question is, how many of these game-changing ideas are going to make it to market? And there's no way to know that now. And I think it's a reasonable assumption that some will, and that they'll have an impact, and that the solar energy market of 10 years from now will be a lot more interesting than today's. But there's no way to know which of these things is going to make what obsolete and make who rich. That's the kind of thing that we have to step back and watch, which is, it's another reason for my writing this book, is because clean tech, even though it's going to be a hot field in general, is extremely dangerous because you have breakthroughs coming out daily, some of which
you have announcements coming out daily.
Announcements. Right, right. So some of it will find its way to the market. Most of it won't. That's the way hot markets normally work. I mean, you've got guys saying all kinds of things, and very few of them, this stuff really pans out, but some of it pans out. And so as an investor, you have to decide whether to take a flyer on this new stuff that's coming out or invest in the old proven technologies and take the risk that it's going to be made obsolete. And so strategically, you can't just go out and say, I want green tech, because you'll end up with a bunch of losers and a few winners. And so you really have to pay attention to it. You really have to have strategies that fit the time and the technology that you're looking at. So it's not simple, and it's dangerous, but it's potentially really lucrative. So it's a fascinating thing to work on because the stakes are high in both directions.
Yeah, it's important for people to understand that it's not always the best technology that is going to be the one that hits the market, because evaluating what's the best varies depending on how you evaluate it, what the measures of effectiveness are, and sometimes
absolutely.
People can get a decent product out and get it established quicker and more successfully than having a perfect product.
Oh yeah, the analogy that gets used a lot is Windows versus Apple computers, because clearly Apple computers, well, most people believe Apple computers were better than PC-based computers. Yeah, and yet they have 5% of the market. Or might be seven or eight now, but
nine
now.
Today.
Good for them. That's cool. But still, somehow Microsoft was able to get the other 90% of the market or whatever. And so the best technology doesn't always win, and that complicates things even further, because the most efficient solar panel might not be the one that makes the most money, or same thing with wind, and the most efficient technology, it might not be the one that wins. I mean, if you just line things up from cheapest to most expensive, you've got nuclear down here as the cheapest, and it's with coal and natural gas, then you've got solar way over here as the most expensive, and yet tons of money is flowing into solar, and so that. We'll see whether that turns out to be a good idea or a bad idea, but right now that's what's happening.
Well, the interesting thing is that there is tons of money flowing into natural gas today.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you add the top half dozen natural gas producers in the U.S., their capital investment in new production for natural gas is in the tens of billions of dollars every year. Just drilling new wells.
Yeah. Natural gas's advantage is that it's here. It's a completely domestic energy source. And there's a lot to be said for that geopolitically. We don't have to send any money to OPEC to be able to heat our homes and whatever with natural gas.
But if you pay attention to the plans of ExxonMobil and Shell, eventually natural gas will be traded internationally almost as much as oil.
Yeah. And Saudi Arabia has huge amounts of natural gas, so they're making plans to liquefy it and ship it. And but again, natural gas is if global warming turns out to be a policy driver going forward, we're going to make natural gas a lot more expensive too, because we're going to allocate the costs of the perceived costs, predicted costs of global warming onto it, so its price goes up.
Right. It's funny because a lot of the natural gas producers, like Chesapeake Energy and stuff, try to emphasize their cleanliness compared to coal, but they still produce about 2/3 of the carbon dioxide for every unit of power that coal does.
It's a good thing they have coal out there to compare themselves to.
Well, that's the one final question I have for you is, in your evaluation of markets and your paying attention for a lot of years, how much do you think FUD plays into the acceptance or rejection of a technology. You're aware of that term, right?
No, I'm not.
Okay, now I'm going to embarrass myself. I have these moments where I lose track of things, but FUD is the... I just lost it. It's basically saying bad things about your competition, snide remarks and whatnot. And one of my theories is that part of the reason that nuclear is so has had so little respect over the years is that some of its competition didn't want the competition that nuclear can provide.
Oh, well, that's, yeah. When you're up against ExxonMobil and
fear, uncertainty, and doubt, that's what it is.
Oh, okay. So you sow the seeds of uncertainty by spreading rumors and things like that. Oh, yeah, sure. Without a doubt, the oil companies and the car companies and the natural gas companies would rather just see nuclear off the field, because in terms of cost and reliability, it puts them to shame. And
emissions.
Yeah, and emissions. That's right. So, without a doubt, there is that. And I don't know. I think that as I said, nuclear definitely has a part to play going forward. And I think that it'll be interesting to see how we deal with the aging of the current generation of nuclear plants. Because it's possible that, the impulse of the incoming government is just going to be to let them die a natural death and not replace them. And that creates a huge vacuum that we'd have to fill with other energy sources. And
I'm a little more optimistic based on the selection of the National Security Advisor as a guy who just spent about a year coming up with an energy strategy for the Chamber of Commerce. And he had some very solid, strong arguments for nuclear.
Okay.
That,
right.
Was part of it, what he provided to President Obama as a transition idea. So
okay.
That's a little bit less. Hey, John, why don't you tell people where they can find your book and a little bit about your website?
Okay. The book's available basically everywhere. You can go to Amazon or Borders or Barnes & Noble, and it's there now. And the website is greenstockinvesting.com, and it's basically set up to be a general news site for clean tech investing. So there are lots of different categories based on the different technologies and the different stocks out there. And there are stock lists, so you can go and get if you want to invest in wind or geothermal or whatever, you can find a list of stocks there that will allow you to get started. And it's updated continuously with all the breaking news in the field. And so it's designed to be a place where you go, spend a half hour in the morning, and you've kind of got you have a handle on what's going on in your fields of interest.
Okay, and just as a reminder to folks, because it was mentioned at the very beginning of the show and we haven't said it since, the book that we're talking about is Clean Money, Picking Winners in the Green Tech Boom. And it was John Rubino, and hope that you all have a good evening, day, whatever time you're listening to this show.
Okay, thanks, Rod.
Thanks, John.
All right. Hey, that was fun.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
If you like that Atomic show, please remember that it doesn't get delivered to you by magic. There's a lot of back-end infrastructure that requires administration, servers, bandwidth, and all that's provided to us by the Podcast Network. So here's Cameron Riley, the owner of the Podcast Network, to ask for your help in keeping independent media like the Atomic show alive.
Hi, folks. This is Cameron Riley from the Podcast Network, here for a short but special and important announcement. We're launching the first ever TPN pledge drive. Now, for those of you that live in countries where you have public radio like NPR in the United States or Triple R in Australia, you'll probably be familiar with the concept of pledge drives. It's basically where they ask the audience to contribute some money to help cover the running costs and help keep independent media running. Now, these are usually radio stations that aren't funded by corporate advertising dollars, and TPN is very much the same. Over the last 4 years that we've been running TPN, I've pretty much funded it out of my own pocket. We've taken bits of advertising here and there, which has helped from time to time, but we've never really taken much advertising. Advertising in podcasts is still a rarity. And with the current financial crisis and the way that advertisers are pulling back online, I don't expect it to be something that's really going to take off over the next year. So what we're going to be doing now is asking you to make voluntary donations to help support independent media. Now, the way that we're doing this is using PayPal as a donation mechanism, and I've put up a blog post that has links to the donation buttons. You can find that at tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com/pledge, and that's spelled P-L-E-D-G-E for those of you that are hard of spelling. And basically the idea is that you can contribute some funds to TPN, which I'll then be able to use to keep the doors open, keep the servers running, and keep the indie media happening. Now, we've been experimenting with this on the Biography Show over the last 6 months, and it's been very well received and very well supported by the audience. And we found a lot of people are willing to contribute like a monthly donation of a couple of bucks, which is great. And there's some other people that have been willing to throw in one-off donations of $20, $50, $100. I have one listener who's contributing $130 a month. And he basically said, look, I'm just spending that money on DVDs or CDs anyway. And as I tend to listen to all the podcasts on TPN, that's where I feel the money should go. But we're not going to be making donations mandatory. Obviously, it's voluntary, the content will remain free for as long as we can keep TPN running. But I would urge you to give serious thought to the role of independent media in your life versus a world of corporate media. And we all know that corporate media, advertising-funded media, to a large degree, the content is driven by the advertising and what the advertisers want people to see or hear or read. And I feel that independent media, if we want it to grow and be successful over the course of the next few years, we really need to think of alternative models for funding it. And independent media, I think, can and should be funded by the audience. You know, we don't have the cost base of a large media company, but we do have costs. And as I'm sure you know, we spend a lot of time and effort in producing shows for you. And so I think it would be great if we could see an independent media that was entirely funded by audience donations. So there'll be a link to the donation page in the show notes for this podcast, but also you can go up to tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com/pledge. And if you listen to a number of podcasts on TPN, I would urge you to support each of those. There's a box in the sponsorship page there where you can type in the name of the podcast that you're supporting along with how much you want to support. And I'm hoping that this will be enough to keep the doors open at TPN. So thanks for listening, and I look forward to speaking to you soon.
There's a way, such a better way today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.